This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, an update on U.S. politics. The Republican plan to overhaul health care faces opposition from both moderate and conservative senators. The U.S. Supreme Court permits a scaled-back version of President Donald Trump's ban on travelers from six mostly Muslim countries to take effect. And Democrats are 0-for-4 in a series of special elections in Kansas, Montana, South Carolina, and Georgia. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. Recent weeks have been full of stunning political developments. Democrats' hopes of winning an open special election in a historically Republican Georgia district were dashed. Democrat John Ossoff lost to Republican Karen Handel, who won the seat vacated by Tom Price, who was named Health and Human Services Secretary. It was considered the most expensive congressional race in U.S. history. And Republicans are in an uphill battle to make good on a core promise to American voters, repealing and replacing former President Barack Obama's signature health care law known as Obamacare. By week's end, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had to postpone a vote before the 4th of July recess because he did not have the votes to pass the repeal bill. And the U.S. Supreme Court gave a partial victory to President Donald Trump, allowing parts of his revised travel ban to take effect until it reviews the issue definitively in October. Mr. Trump's executive order bans granting new visas from travelers from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen for 90 days and suspends the U.S. refugee program for 120 days. Well, joining us for a conversation on these and other issues dominating the U.S. political landscape are William Galston. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies Program. He is a former advisor to President Bill Clinton and an expert on domestic policy, political campaigns, and elections. And John Fortier. He's a veteran at these VOA microphones. He's director of Bipartisan Policy Center's Democracy Project, and he is a regular columnist for The Hill and Politico, and a frequent commentator on elections and government institutions. Well, John Fortier joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
And Bill Galston joins us from a studio at the Brookings Institution. Bill, welcome to you.
Good to be here.
Let me begin with you, John Fortier, here in the studio. The so-called the GOP, the Republican health care bill. Senate Republicans are trying to revive this health care effort, but they still remain divided on an issue that arguably represents 1/6 of the U.S. economy. What happened to repealing and replacing Obamacare, John?
Well, I think there's some bad short-term news for Republicans, and I think the long-term news is at least mixed and also might not be so great. Certainly, Republicans as a principle agreed on this idea that they would repeal and then put something in place of Obamacare. Once one gets down to the details, it's much more difficult. And you saw in the House of Representatives earlier this year, several machinations finally getting a bill passed. I think Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, believed he could get something through the Senate, a different bill than the House, and was not able to do that at this time, had to pull that. For the short term, they're going to regroup after they come back from the congressional recess and try to work another bill, and that may happen. So one caution is, I think some people may think, well, all of this messiness is dooming Republicans getting a bill done. Look, this is part of a normal process to get a major piece of legislation done. We shouldn't expect it to happen overnight. There are going to be a lot of twists and turns, and both bodies are going to have to agree on things. I think the tricky thing for Republicans in the long term is they may get a bill. I think there's a lot of incentive for them to ultimately get something done. But the popularity of what they're trying to pass is really quite low. I would say even lower than Obamacare was, but it reminds a little bit of President Obama having spent a lot of time getting Obamacare through and finding at the end of the day it was an accomplishment, but it still wasn't popular with the American people. Even if Republicans ultimately get a victory, it's likely that it's not going to help them electorally and might be, you know, a negative for them politically.
Turning to you, Bill Galston, at the Brookings Institution studio, for your take on what happened to this process of repealing and replacing Obamacare by the July 4th recess. It seemed like the Senate Republicans, particularly Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, was going to have a success. But I would take issue with something that John Fortier said. He said that there was a normal process of getting a piece of major legislation through. I've heard said that the bill was basically written in secret, and this was not a very popular process. Tell me how you see this whole episode.
Well, let me begin by expressing my astonishment that 7 years after Republicans vowed collectively to repeal and replace Obamacare, they didn't come to closure on what replacement would look like. And it became very, very clear in January that virtually no serious consensus building work had been done within the party. And I'm trying to figure out why they wasted 7 years. I guess it's a lot easier to oppose than it is to govern. And the question on the table now is whether the Republicans, who are a majority party, are actually a governing party. And I think the jury is still out on that. Here is the big problem, and it's a substantive problem. The Medicaid expansion, which is, I believe, the principal element of Obamacare.
And let's define Medicaid expansion for our listeners.
Okay. Medicaid is the health care program that principally serves low-income Americans, regardless of age, and also indigent elderly Americans who find themselves in need of nursing home care. The Obamacare expansion extended Medicaid above the poverty line to cover many people who qualify as working class and the working poor. It turns out that the major beneficiaries of that expansion are working class voters who supported Donald Trump in droves. His greatest support was in what I'll call Greater Appalachia, starting with West Virginia, encompassing pieces of Pennsylvania and Ohio, but particularly Kentucky, Arkansas, etc. And hundreds of thousands of Trump supporters stand to lose their eligibility for guaranteed health care. And a lot of Republican senators from those states are understandably very, very cautious about going down that road. But the Medicaid repeal, the expansion repeal, is how the bill gets $800 billion, which until very, very recently was going to be dedicated to tax cuts.
Well, since we're talking about the politics of this health care bill, back to you, John Fortier. Repealing Obamacare was, as you both intimated, a unifying call for Republicans for most of the Obama administration. So why, in your view, has this unity fallen apart in this debate over the health care bill?
Well, I partly share Bill's criticism that more could have been done by Republicans in advance to coalesce around something. Although I do note that when you have a new majority, many of these members are new to the Congress, are not on the committees that take this sort of thing up, you're almost going to have to forge a new consensus. And what we saw in the House and what we're seeing in the Senate now is, you know, a push and a pull from different parts of the coalition. Yes, Republicans have a majority, but they have some constraints. And those the majority itself has a conservative wing or a free market wing, which is really much more interested in reform and repeal and moving towards a more of a free market system and pushed the bill, House bill, sometimes in that direction. You also do have many moderate and swing state senators who are being pulled in the other direction. So that's difficult. I will note also that our procedures here in the Congress make it difficult to get something to the Senate, which in many cases requires 60 votes. To get a 50-vote majority vote, you need to use special procedures. We call them reconciliation. That limits what Republicans can do. All that being said, you know, I think it's tough for Republicans, and they are politically going to have to, I think the best case scenario for them is ultimately to work their way through this and find a solution. I think they're going to address some of what Bill is talking about, but probably not to the satisfaction of the Congressional Budget Office, which is going to have a finding, I'm sure, that many people will lose their health care to some state senators. But even if that bill passes, I think it's going to be hard to imagine that it's going to be a very popular platform to run on in the next election. Worse, I think, would be nothing done leading up to this and not getting something done at all. But it's a long process, and it's not going to be the slam dunk politically that it seemed to be early on in the Obama administration when Republicans could simply just say, we're against Obamacare, and the replacement is a bit vague.
Back to you, Bill Galston. Between nothing and getting reform, a Republican bill passed, is there a middle way? We're seeing national surveys showing that Obamacare, the health care law that Mr. Obama got passed, is winning new popularity even as Republicans are trying to keep their campaign pledge about repealing it and replacing it. And polls now are showing that many Americans don't like the Republican proposal on the table that you described. Are there prospects for a bipartisan approach at the end of the day, do you think, maybe tweaking the current law?
Well, Senator McConnell publicly warned his colleagues, his Republican colleagues, that if they couldn't get to yes on a Republican bill, that they would have no choice but to negotiate with the Democrats. He presented that as a truly horrible alternative. There are many Americans who would welcome it. And if the Republicans were acting in their self-interest, rightly understood, to seize a phrase from Tocqueville, they would probably go down that road, because the Republican alternative to Obamacare is not only much less popular than Obamacare now, but much less popular than Obamacare ever was. And, you know, Obamacare was wallowing around in the low to mid 40s for a long time. Support for the Republican alternative is about 25%. I would hate to go to the country next year with a 25% approval on my key legislative accomplishment. There are a lot of Republican strategists who have privately told me that they think the party would be better off if the entire effort collapsed.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Bill Galston, he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, from whom you just heard, and John Fortier, director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Democracy Project. And we're discussing the U.S. political landscape, the Senate health care bill. Pretty soon we'll be discussing special elections and, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on Mr. Trump's travel ban. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to our dedicated producer and booker, Anna Zalewski. Anna has been working at The Voice of America for 33 years. With us here, our current affairs programs Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News for the last 14 years. This is her last day at the VOA. We will greatly miss her, and we appreciate everything she has done for us. Well, back to our program. Back to you here in the studio, John Fortier. Let's turn now to the Supreme Court's decision on the travel ban, President Trump's travel ban. How do you read that?
Well, I think if you look historically, the courts have generally been relatively deferential to a president making decisions in the national interest with respect to immigration specifically. But the president came out with, some would argue, he certainly has a polarizing nature. I think he had a polarizing plan and an early and surprising and not well rolled out early travel ban. And courts, especially courts with Democratic judges, reacted very strongly against this. I think the president didn't help himself in a number of ways in the way he presented this. What the Supreme Court has done is not make a final decision on this, but has essentially taken off the stay that the lower court had put on this. So the lower court had said, you can't go forward with this, you got to stop. They allowed it in many cases. There are some exceptions for people who have close family relationships or relationships with government institutions. So in this interim period, that order will still be stayed for them. Those people will be allowed to come and travel into the United States. And ultimately, that case may be decided in the fall on the merits. There's been no decision on the merits. It may be that by the time we get to that case, the travel ban or most of it, the time limits have already passed and some of this is moot. But the court did correct a bit from the, I think, back to a more normal position of court, saying the executive has some real leeway in this area to limit people. But I think it's in the context of this, you know, very contentious thing that has gotten the courts worked up against the president in a way that probably we traditionally don't see.
Well, Bill Galston, how do you read the courts, the Supreme Court's decision giving a sort of a partial victory to President Trump, allowing parts of his revised travel ban to take effect until it actually reviews the issue definitively in October? What's the significance and implications of that decision?
Well, much the same as John's interpretation. I think the Supreme Court, although it didn't fully reach the merits, stands for the proposition that the president has considerable authority over immigration, but not unlimited authority, and that in important respects, the first order went too far. The exceptions that John mentioned are material and significant. Reports from airports since the revised ban went into effect suggests that it's a much more orderly process than it was at the beginning of the Trump administration. People understand the rules, that they were given time to react and change their plans if need be, and that you have much less confusion than there was. So I think a lot of the heat surrounding this issue is gradually subsiding. I very much hope that the administration will use the 90 days that the court has approved to come up with a coherent plan that will be more unifying politically and that can pass legal and constitutional muster. If so, then this will be seen more as a blip than as a fundamental change of direction.
There will be a lot of discussion about this, and many national security experts still cast some doubt on the singling out of countries of origin as perhaps a way to oversee who comes in and goes from the country. But we'll see in the coming weeks and months. Let's now turn to special elections, John Fortier. These four special elections held, the Democrats were eager for a win in, one could say, predominantly Republican districts, particularly in Georgia. They didn't win any of the seats. How do you view this for the Democrats?
Well, the specific news for Democrats is bad. They obviously have lost these four elections, and especially the one in Georgia, which we've just recently had, was one with so much attention and so much money put to it. It was a high-stakes election. But I think the longer-term news is broadly good for Democrats. These are all seats that were overwhelmingly Republican seats and became closer because of the atmosphere, because of, I would say, a normal process by which the president's party doesn't do as well in midterm elections. Usually there's a reaction against him. And a president like Donald Trump, now sitting at 40% or so job approval ratings, that reaction is stronger. So I think there may be some good news in the sense that there will be other seats up in the midterm election which are more winnable, which are closer seats, that will be, you know, more likely to change parties. So I think the Democrats were disappointed. It still shows that there's some strength and strength of the base out there on the Republican side, but these were pretty Republican seats. The only thing particular I'll say about the Georgia race is that was an interesting case in that was a very Republican district, but one that did not vote very much for Donald Trump. It had voted for Mitt Romney. It was a very educated district, the most Republican, most educated district among Republican districts. And that gave some people the thought that that would be more likely to change even than some of these other ones. And it didn't ultimately. But that is the place where Donald Trump has lost some support in the Republican Party while he's gained in other areas. Those are the types of seats that Democrats will be looking for, ones that are a little closer than that in the fall of 2018, but are more winnable.
Turning to you, Bill Galston, for your interpretation of the results of these elections, what's your takeaway for both the Democrats and the Republicans?
Very much the same as John's. These were districts that Republicans have historically won by very large margins, double-digit margins. And in at least two of the cases, can't summon up the precise quantitative results of all four, but in at least two of the cases, the margins were much smaller than that, in the low single digits. That suggests that overall, the Democrats are not in bad shape going into the midterm elections. And in fact, I've seen a couple of surveys in the past week giving Democrats about a 10 percentage point edge over Republicans when they're asked about their voting preferences for the House of Representatives next year. The standard political science analysis, given more wasted votes on the Democratic side than the Republican side, is that 6 percentage points or more would probably be enough to tip the balance in the House of Representatives in favor of the Democrats. So if they go into the midterms with anything like the 10-point margin in popular support that they now enjoy, the Republicans, I think, will be in for some really rough sledding. And the task of the Republican Party is to narrow that margin by actually getting some things done in Congress that the American people like. So far, their scorecard is blank.
Well, thank you, Bill, because you just led me into my next and final question, which is, indeed, there's not a lot to point to in terms of accomplishments, John Fortier, on the part of the Republicans who are in the majority, and Mr. Trump in particular. He's almost 6 months into his tenure. He doesn't have a lot of accomplishments to point to, especially if health care, the Republican version of the health care bill, ultimately fails. How important is it for him and his administration to get back on track and fulfill campaign pledges or adjust them in terms of public opinion?
Well, I think it is important. I mean, I give the Trump administration a bit of leeway on this, and that major legislation often takes some time. Obamacare itself took, you know, nearly a year to get done. So it is not too late. You know, they have other worries that the bills themselves won't be popular. But the hope is for the Republicans that they will pass health care, that they will do something on tax cuts, that they will ultimately get to some infrastructure, which in theory might have the support of both parties or cut across traditional coalitions. But that's a lot to do. And so they still have time. I think the political calendar allows you to really push with majorities up until, you know, April or May or maybe even June of next year before political season really kicks in. So if we come back here at that time and find that things have been done by then, I think that's helpful to them. But, you know, right now they're in a tricky position. We'll see if they can get that done. They have some time, but it's not – they've not gotten the early win that they would have been nice for them.
Well, indeed. Well, we can always count on John Fortier for being an optimist, a cautious optimist. But again, back to you, Bill Galston. Mr. Trump, 6 months into his tenure, doesn't have a lot of accomplishments to point to, especially if the health care bill fails. His poll numbers are declining. And, you know, even the U.S. image overseas seems to be suffering. We're seeing polls in that regard. So how do you assess the administration thus far? Are you equally cautiously optimistic that they can get back on track? What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't rule out in any way a Republican agreement on major legislation over the next 12 months between now and next June for a very simple reason, and I think Mitch McConnell highlighted it, the Senate Majority Leader. If Republicans don't hang together, they'll hang separately. And there is nothing like the sight of the gallows to concentrate a man's mind. So there are some real incentives for Republicans to get together, certainly on tax reform, which is even more of a signature Republican issue than the health care issue is. More broadly, however, Mr. Trump came into office with the support of about 46.5% of the American people. And I would have thought that job one for the Trump administration was to reach out to people who hadn't supported him and to give them reasons to support him in at least some respects. I am frankly astonished that the administration went in exactly the opposite direction and made a series of early decisions that it must have known would be divisive, would do nothing to build popular support towards a sustainable majority. And I suppose there are some reasons why they proceeded in that way, but for the long-term interests and objectives of the administration, I don't see how those early moves were productive in any way. And as far as I can tell, nothing has been done to correct those early decisions or to change course. And so I don't think that the prospects for Mr. Trump to raise his popular approval ratings or job approval ratings even as high as the mid-40s, which corresponds to the share of the American people who supported him in 2016, I don't see how he does that on his current course.
And just one very last question, very quickly. John Fortier, Russia probe. We have the special counsel, Robert Mueller, investigating Russian interference in the U.S. election and even potential ties between the Trump campaign and the Russians. To what extent that's going to trip up, in your view, the Trump administration in the coming days?
Well, it's not something any administration would like to see, and I think this is particularly under the skin of the Trump administration, Trump himself. So it's not a good thing. It's out of the president's control to much of a degree. So I don't think it helps. I think if you look at his approval numbers, really two things have caused his numbers to go down. They were never that high, but he was at about the 45% that Bill is talking about. First, when he delved into in the health care bill with the House, he went down. And second, when he fired Jim Comey, he went down. And he's sitting at about 40% now. Those are things that are not helping the president and not likely to go away right away.
One quick last word for you, Bill Galston, on the Russia probes and how that may stymie or hinder Mr. Trump.
There are persistent rumors that the president would like to get rid of the special counsel, Bob Mueller. If he does that, I think he will trigger a serious move towards impeachment.
On that ominous note, I'm afraid that is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Bill Galston, he's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution here in Washington, and John Fortier, director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Democracy Project. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your wonderful insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.